On the next episode of Piled High and Deep, the podcast, I realize I really didn't retain all that information from my biology classes. So I had one in high school and then the one that I barely passed in college. I really do understand the difference, though, between animals with skeletons inside their bodies and those that have shells. But I digress. Let's get on with the show. Today on the program, our journey is with an evolutionary biologist. She spends an awful lot of time in museums studying vertebrates. Again, those animals with skeletons inside them. And you can tell from our conversation, she has a real passion for her work. And it's a passion that started all with her father.
My dad is a high school biology teacher, and, you know, we spent the summers fishing and hunting and camping and backpacking. And so I always was, you know, I always had this great appreciation of the natural world. So when I decided to add on wildlife biology as an undergraduate, I got involved in the Natural History Museum.
And did you catch there where she said add on? It's important to note that, because this journey didn't start all science-y and stuff. It actually started with a focus on art. And you may ask yourself, how does an artist decide to, you know, go on to biology? Well, I didn't understand that there really is a connection between evolutionary biology and art, and it all starts with patterns.
Well, art is, you know, about finding these kind of interesting lines in the world that you try to depict in a way that makes them come alive for other people that maybe didn't notice that, right? So it could be emotional or it could be something natural, but it's about finding a pattern and showing that in a way to a particular visual audience. In this case, I do mostly visual art. But in science, I do the same thing. I look for patterns in the world and try to figure out what causes those patterns. And so my mind is mostly about doing pattern detection and trying to understand, does this have, you know, a basis in like the history of the world or the underlying evolution or ecology?
Art and the evolutionary biologist with a little sprinkle of high adventure in Central America. That's all today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conte Jr. You can check out my blog. I need to be writing more on it, but it's themountaingeek.net. I'm also on Twitter, at themountaingeek. You can also check out the Twitter feed for the podcast, at PhD Podcast. And if you happen to like the program, please tell me about it. Send me an email, make a comment on wherever it is that you listen to or get the podcast at any one of those wonderful podcast delivery services, whether it's podcast app, Stitcher, Podbean, whatever they are. Just leave a comment. Tell your friends about it. Need to get some listeners. But, okay, I'm not going to beg for listeners, but I will beg for guests. So if you happen to know any PhDs out there, please put us together. Hook us up. Make a match, if you will. And would love to talk to them. So this episode with Christy McCain is really great. I enjoyed sitting down with her. Got to admit, I kind of caught her off guard. Again, I have to thank Andy Schneidkraut up at Albums on the Hill in Boulder for putting us together. But it turned out to be a great interview. I learned a lot. But I think what's really interesting about this adventure is how it really kind of transformed and moved. And we also talk about the work that she's doing in developing other new PhDs. So let's start shoveling, and I got to get that email. So, Christy, meeting Kevin as we walked out the door here. I liked his nifty little bird collection. He said that he doesn't work here anymore. Is he one of your... Is he a graduate student?
He's a PhD student, just about to finish.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah.
And is that the kind of work that you do a lot of work with with graduate students, PhD students, that?
Yes. So, yeah, it's definitely part of the science faculty in general, we're tasked with developing a lab that includes, you know, having quite a few grad students. Okay. That are always getting kind of going through a training scenario because, yeah, I mean, we're essentially part of our job is to train the next generation of scientists.
What is the younger generation of scientists look like compared to maybe what you saw in yourself?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, because each person's so unique.
Right.
And I think that was true when I started and when, you know, the group of people that are attracted to it now. Kevin in this case is only like a year younger than me. So we're not that different in our generation. But the student that just graduated is probably 10 years younger than us, both of us, or maybe more, maybe 15. So I think, you know, I think it really varies. I think the biggest difference is that I think historically PhDs in the sciences were more independent. So where, you know, the advisor just said, find a project, do that project, I'll give you feedback, come back to me when you have results, and we'll talk about, you know, how good that is.
Right.
Whereas now it's maybe a little bit more hands-on. Maybe that's partly the student and partly the faculty, because maybe a lot of the faculty thought that was too little when we were students. Or it means that some students maybe need a little more encouragement. But it is challenging, you know? Doing a PhD is not easy. And you're in that time in your life that you're questioning what you're going to do with the rest of your life. And so I think because they're in turmoil, like, is this the right thing? Am I studying the right thing that will bring me to the career I want? And, you know, the people that I'm meeting, are these the people I want to be with, you know, and that kind of thing, that they're in a kind of a part of their life that is inherently tumultuous, you know? And so I think that that maybe is a little more part of our job than it was for our advisors who, you know, kind of kept the personal life out of it a little bit more.
Is that just a result of maybe coming together as more of a community aspect of it? It's not to say that your advisor didn't care about you, but we've maybe changed a little bit as a society and wanted to be a little bit more caring and nurturing and making sure that you want more warm fuzzies than you got to help your kids.
Yeah, and just that giving more advice makes things smoother.
Right.
Right. And just giving advice at the end of a project or, you know, when they've been working on it for a couple years and then giving advice, you know, probably is not so efficient.
What is it that you exactly do here at the University of Colorado?
So I wear several hats.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm a faculty member. So I'm a faculty member in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department. But I'm also a curator here in the CU Museum of Natural History. So I'm the curator of vertebrates. And then, so our faculty jobs are 40% research. Then we have 20% is the curation. And I do 20% teaching. And then the other 20% of our job is service. And that's service in the general sense, so just service to our department and the museum, but also that includes service to your discipline. So whether that be at the national, international level, or even at the college or kind of the university level. So that's also an expectation of faculty to be participating and moving kind of your field forward, not just in the science sense.
By vertebrates, that's everything with bones in it, right?
Right.
Not fish, but
backbones.
Backbones?
Yep, fish are in
there. Oh, fish also?
Yep.
Okay, all right.
Yep, so fish.
I didn't do very well in biology. it was a whole other bad story, but
yeah.
Okay. So most animals fall into...
Yeah, most of the ones that we kind of think about in general, uh-huh. Right? So fish... reptiles, amphibians, birds,
mammals.
Okay. Yeah. So that's my domain. And then in the museum, we have an invertebrate curator, you know, so things without backbone.
Right. And, oh, that lobster that I had for dinner a couple of weeks ago.
Exactly. All right, got it. Sponges, millipedes.
Now I'm remembering. Okay.
Yeah. And then we have entomology, and we have herbarium, and then we have paleovertebrates and paleoinvertebrates.
The dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs, yes. And, tracks of dinosaurs. And then we have in the museum as well, there is anthropology. So in this area, it's mostly studying Southwest Native Americans.
Before we get into a little bit more on your background, is this kind of what you envisioned yourself doing, as young teenage Christy McCain doing her thing?
A little bit. So as I mentioned earlier, I went to college to be an artist. And then I added on wildlife biology sort of halfway through when I realized, you know, where you had to live to be an artist was usually a big city. And I didn't really like that. So I had grown up, my dad is a high school biology teacher. And, you know, we spent the summers fishing and hunting and camping and backpacking. And so I always was, you know, I always had this great appreciation of the natural world. So when I decided to add on wildlife biology as an undergraduate, I got involved in a natural history museum. So they had a small natural history museum. I went to the Humboldt State in Northern California. And that's where I got interested in museums. And so just as a volunteer for the last 3 years of my undergrad. And so I really liked that. I started out as a mammalogist. So my true research area is mammalogy, so that's the study of mammals in particular. And so I ran into a friend of mine from when I was an undergrad, and he asked me what I was doing, and I told him that I was a professor and that I was the curator of vertebrates, and he said, that's very strange, because that's exactly what you told me you were going to do when we were undergrads. And I didn't actually remember that. I remembered more like vacillating between art and science and conservation. But I guess at some point it was, you know, kind of a goal, and it turned out to be the case.
So one of the things about Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is I want to talk about that journey. What led you to that? You said your father was a high school biology teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up hunting, fishing. Mm-hmm. Where was that?
Northern California. Okay. Yeah.
Alrighty.
Yeah, so...
school was obviously important.
Yeah, oh yeah. My dad's, unlike, you know, a lot of people you meet that are hunters and fishermen, that he was more on the, you know, loved the biology. Like, let's get this fish and dissect it, you know?
I grew up the same way. Before we started, I said, you know, I grew up, my mother was a birder. Same thing with fishing. We didn't worry about... Our idea of fly fishing was the first fish that was keepable that day, cut it open, figure out what was in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry if you're eating breakfast while you're listening to this. Figure out, you know, what you can dig up from the side of the river and go at it, and you're going to catch fish all day.
Yeah.
Or grasshoppers.
Yeah, or yeah, whatever. My dad loved to, you know, just talk about and learn about, you know, all the different trees and all the different plants. And so, you know, we learned how to, you know, skin a deer at, you know, 6 years old. So, you know, that, I mean,
it's really
is
not that hard, let's be honest.
No, yeah, it's true. It's not. It's really gross. Not in the biological sense, but in the smell sense.
Yes, yes. It's not pleasant.
But it is amazing, you know, as a child or as any kind of person that you don't normally, unless you're like a surgeon, you don't usually get to see the insides of a working animal, and something as big as a deer, which is, you know, bigger than us, you get to see how we're put together, and it's truly amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, everything fits in like a puzzle, you know, and there's no empty space, no wasted space, so it's pretty, you know, as a child, it's fascinating.
I haven't had a chance to say one of my favorite words, gut ball, on this podcast yet, but, you know, the guts just kind of roll out when you remove, you know. It's just a couple of snips here and there, and it just rolls away.
It does. Yeah, and it's much worse if it, you know, you don't do it right.
That is true. Yes, absolutely. The were you just expected to go to college? That was just boom right there? You know, out of the womb, Christy's going to college.
Oh yeah, I mean, both my parents went to college, but I come from a non-traditional family in that my parents had me in their 40s, and at the time, you know, my mom's now 80, going to be 89 very soon. That was unheard of at that time, and so, but you know, my mom was also a high school teacher, and so you know, it was just assumed that you went to high school and college.
Right.
Even though that they both came from very more disadvantaged families. Like my grandparents moved here and farmed in North Dakota and had 12 kids, and then my dad grew up in Northern California, but, you know, a family that just kind of pieced life together, you know, in sort of blue collar labor. And so, but I think really that is an expectation, and both me and my brother went to college. They did not emphasize like grades. They didn't care. You know, they were more into that we learned and we liked instead of emphasizing you being the best in school. So it was never like, you know, do a PhD or be the valedictorian. Like, they didn't have those expectations of us at all. It was more like, just do what you love.
Take advantage of the opportunity to stuff as much knowledge in your brain as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And both of them are pretty social, so I would say that they, in some cases, even emphasize the social aspects of life and science and schooling as much as they did, that the true learning or the, you know, book learning.
Did your brother, does he have an advanced degree as well, or?
No, he got a degree in botany. So I think that, you know, that love of the outside world was true of both of us. But we both worked all through high school and college. And one of the things that we both worked for was that the high school district my parents worked for would hire the teacher's students to work in the summer. And in maintenance mostly.
Right.
So like there was a painting crew and electrician's crew, you know, all, you know, like grounds, all those different things. My brother did the electrical work. I was a painter. And my brother learned how to do everything as an electrician essentially in high school and early college. And so he has his own business now. He's a solar, does mostly solar, but also just regular electrical.
I want to get back to the art aspect, and mm-hmm. I think we'll touch on this a couple of times going down, but oftentimes we don't think of art and science as really having an intersection.
Mm.
How did you find that progression throughout your academic life? As a biologist, probably makes it a little easier because you know how to draw the animal, and it's mm-hmm. not, you know, it's mm-hmm. going to look better than the stick figure that I would be drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And not having to rely on an outside source, you can take care of your own. But
mm-hmm.
we think of art and science as being that left brain, right brain.
Mm-hmm.
Did it make a difference for you, you think? When you take a look at your contemporaries, did it give you an advantage, maybe?
I don't know if it gave me an advantage, but I asked different questions. I think what interests me is maybe different. So, I did start drawing stuff outside, right? Like pine cones and, you know, flowers and that kind of thing. And when I first started learning how to draw. And then even in college, I did a lot of really what you would term representational drawing. So very detailed, kind of very specific, you know, I did a lot of skulls actually,
right?
You know, stuff like that. But I would say the same thing that interests me about art and science are the patterns. So the big scale patterns. So art is, you know, about finding these kind of interesting lines in the world that you try to depict in a way that makes them come alive for other people that maybe didn't notice that, right? So it could be emotional or it could be something natural. but it's about finding a pattern and showing that in a way to a particular visual audience. In this case, I do mostly visual art. But in science, I do the same thing. I look for patterns in the world and try to figure out what causes those patterns. And so my mind is mostly about doing pattern detection and trying to understand, does this have, you know, a basis in, like, the history of the world or the underlying evolution or ecology? So I would say they're not that unrelated. I mean, I've met a lot of biologists at the PhD level that are either musicians or artists or, you know, have some interest in something that's incredibly creative outside of science. So I think maybe it's just curiosity. You know, we want to try a different, you know, that particular type of brain wants to try a lot of different things. But
you finish your undergrad. You have 2 degrees then?
I do, yeah.
What was that next step you took? Was it immediately off to graduate school?
No. I did the Peace Corps. So I applied in my last semester to look into going to the Peace Corps because I wanted to see more of the world, you know, and I was interested in conservation really early on in, you know, doing something applied with science. And so I thought that Peace Corps would be a good experience to see the parts of the world that, you know, don't have as much and as many resources to do the kinds of things that potentially somewhere like the North American can do. So, so I applied for the Peace Corps, and I ended up going within 3 months or so of graduating. And I went to Honduras as my group were wildlife biologists.
We often think of the Peace Corps as being a person-to-person activity. Mm-hmm. I'm going there, I'm building, you know, providing water, food, sanitation. It doesn't sound like what you did.
Yeah. So there were all those things, environmental education, all those different health, different groups of people. Our particular group was, so the way the Peace Corps works is that the country actually asks the U.S. government. They do negotiations for Peace Corps volunteers, essentially. And so the government has a feeling, you know, like they want this particular type of expertise, and they ask that from Peace Corps. So, for instance, you know, if you go to China, all they really want from the Peace Corps volunteers are English and business. So those are the only volunteers that go there, or at least when I was in the Peace Corps world.
Who knows what they're asking for now, but let's not go down. we'll keep the politics out of it for now.
Yeah. So in this case, it was actually requested from the Honduran government. And the reason why was because they had this fledgling wildlife biology program that was inside of their forestry division as a governmental organization. And they wanted the Peace Corps volunteers to pair with these new wildlife biologists and give them, you know, essentially help them with what we were trained in to give them some resources to apply in their jobs.
What did you find you were successful doing in Honduras for that?
Surviving.
Here's young, early 20s. Northern California girl going to the jungles of Honduras. Yeah, I'm not going to get mid-90s.
So I graduated in 94. And I, you know, I'd follow
it
the
was
dad.
A pretty,
yeah.
That's a pretty wild, rollicking place at that point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so Peace Corps is no longer there, right? They pulled out because it's too dangerous.
Right.
So it was a very dangerous experience for me. So my first 6 months... the town that I was in, there was 70 murders. And there was in the entire region, including the town and the little little towns, which they call aldeas, there was only 1,000 people total. So in 6 months, 70 people were murdered. So it was a really dangerous place. We were working with people trying to do conservation, and our truck got shot at. You know, the people that worked we worked with a teachers group. In fact, they were, you know, conservation-oriented teachers group, and they got death threats every single day. So, you know, it was eye-opening, right? This is, you know, conservation in the time of extraction, you know, and illegal extraction. And so...
And that's what the rub was, right? Because you're trying to stop this extraction of minerals, fauna, flora, you know, animals, mm-hmm. plants, the whole mm-hmm. nine yards.
Mahogany.
Yeah.
And the wealthy are the ones that are paying for this to happen. And so the people that are doing the extractions, you know, they have AK-47s. They have, you know, they're well supplied. And so, it was our... we had two police officers in the town, and at sundown, they locked themselves in the police department. So I ended up getting pulled out because it was too dangerous. And I moved out to an area that was called La Mosquitia, which, you know, we know as, you know, like moviegoers that this is the Mosquitia region of both Honduras and Nicaragua. Which were where the Sandinistas were in the Central American kind of older wars. But anyway, I was in one of the most remote villages that was totally indigenous. So there were two indigenous tribes, the Mosquito people and then the Pesh. And so in this case, my job was really different because we didn't have one of these wildlife biologists. So I worked with the indigenous government. So they sort of have a government within a government, and it was to try to help the local community make money that was in ways that were environmentally sustainable instead of just, you know, cutting down the forest and floating it downriver. And so in this case, we worked with women's groups doing chocolate production, which wasn't hard. And they did native crafts. So a lot of things with bark of trees. And then, you know, what I would call extreme ecotourism. People would come in from, you know, it takes several days to get to this village. But, you know, once you got there, you can see harpy eagles and jaguars and, you know, giant anteaters. So we were in the heart of the lowland rainforest. And the largest one in Honduras. So it was unbelievably beautiful for a biologist.
You did 2 years in the Peace Corps?
Yeah.
After that, immediately to graduate school?
No, I went back to where I got my undergrad degree, and I worked for a year because I wanted to make sure. So this is where I was talking about vacillating between art and science and conservation. I wanted to be sure that I was taking the track that I would be most successful, but also like the best. And the Peace Corps showed me that, you know, conservation on the ground is incredibly challenging, and it's mostly social and political, of course. And those two things are not my forte. And so I knew I needed something that was more trying to solve problems, but kind of more intellectually, you know, or doing experiments or modeling. Or doing a side was totally art-based. So I was looking into whether I was going to do scientific illustration as a career or pure science. And then I looked more into that scientific illustration, and it turns out nowadays it's mostly all medical, and you work for the man.
Right.
You essentially work for pharmaceutical companies, right? And I that's not what I wanted to do. So... after experimenting, then I looked into more tropical mammalogy, which is what, you know, I got really interested in the Peace Corps. And in fact, I got interested in what I study now when I lived in Honduras, which is I study how biodiversity changes on mountains. And in the tropics, it's, you know, the most extreme case of that you every kind of 200 meters, you get a completely different habitat. You know, all the trees change, all the lower understory changes, all the birds change. And so in the tropics, it's just very different and quickly different habitats as you move up in elevation. And so from backpacking in the Peace Corps, I got really interested in that question, like why is there this, you know, repeated pattern and that species are really segregated on the mountain. What's causing that kind of change?
How did you make your decision? I looked at the dissertation. I can't remember the title. I don't have my computer out right now. It ran out of gas. But first of all, how did you end up at the University of Kansas from Northern California?
Yeah. So I looked. So this is an interesting question in choosing PhD schools, is that there's two ways to do it. One is the tax that you want to work with.
Right.
And the other is the question.
Right.
And a lot of us, and I was one of those people, are more, think that it's more about the organisms. And so I looked at all the people that study tropical mammals. And I didn't look so much at that, you know, particular question, because I wasn't sure at that point that's exactly what I wanted to do. And so you can tell the sophistication of a student by whether they are question-oriented and looking at schools versus taxa-oriented. But I can't criticize them because that's what I, you know, right. I did that same thing.
One thing that I've found in talking to PhDs in this project is that, you know, the importance of finding that mentor early on.
Mm-hmm.
Were you in a position during your undergrad? Did you have a mentor that, mm-hmm. that was a guiding figure, whether it was on the, well, I guess you kind of had three tracks going there because you mm-hmm. had the art, you mm-hmm. had the straight biology, and then you were playing around in the museum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you came back from the Peace Corps, did you glom onto them again for a little
really.
Help?
I've been, I still am to this day sort of stubbornly independent.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that either.
But I think I did have a mentor. So the person that was in charge of the museum was a mammalogist. And so, and he turns out, you know, he was a biogeographer, and that's a lot of people put me in that kind of box as a, you know, the questions I ask are biogeography, are about larger scale patterns and how species are distributed around the world. That's biogeography. So I did ask him for ideas and feedback, but I would say, you know, part of the problem with applying to grad school, and this is true here as well for the students that apply, is that there's many more people that are applying that can be accepted. And especially accepted if you want to have funding.
Right.
And so one of the best people to work with was at Berkeley. And I interviewed with him, and he was interested in taking me as a student, but he couldn't take me that first year, because he had too many students already. And so Kansas offered me a full scholarship, including money for research. So it was, you know, and I didn't have any funds, you know, Peace Corps, you give you like $5,000. Thanks for the help. So I couldn't turn that down. And they were two, so I worked with the Natural History Museum and the two mammalogists. I was co-advised by both of the mammalogists, and one was a tropical biologist and the other mammalogist, and the other was a population biologist. And together they were my advisors in the museum.
Rattle, do you remember your dissertation title?
No.
No?
I can look it up. I'm
no,
sure
I
it's
got
around
it.
Here. It's something about small mammals
small
on
mammal
mountains.
Small mountain small mammal diversity on mountains and... latitudinal and elevation changes. When did you have that? Were you on that track pretty quick?
Yeah, so in the first year, I came up with, so in the first year, you have to have a proposal of some ideas that you float with your committee, essentially your advisors and a few people that you
did. You even
together.
Go master's, by the way?
No.
You went straight PhD?
I went straight PhD in that I was already a little older then because of the Peace Corps.
Right.
And a lot of people just said that, you know, it's not as worth your time. And that's, you know, it's true if you already have an idea of what you want to do. then I think it's easier to just do the PhD. If you are not sure about what area in biology you want to go into, I think a master's is super valuable because you get to test a lot of different areas. But in my point, I just wanted to just do a PhD. And so...
And thanks to that Peace Corps work, you already knew... You knew what you wanted to,
right,
to put a focus on.
And I had the advantage of going to Humboldt State where they were, our wildlife biology, every upper division class, we had to do a research project, and we had to do all the steps. So the field work, the statistics, write it up as a scientific paper, and give a scientific talk. So by the time I graduated, I had already done that 6 times. And that's unusual. Like, we don't do that here at CU. Yep. We just don't have the resources to do that for, you know, we have thousands of students instead of, you know, a couple hundred. So so I felt like I was poised to, you know, I knew how to design a study, maybe just a tiny study, but I felt like I already knew the steps that I would take to do a scientific study. So I felt poised to do that. But yeah, so I had a few proposals that were really quite different, but I did have my heart set on the elevational diversity question.
At the beginning of your PhD program, did you have a sense as to what you wanted to accomplish afterward? Did you have either a specific goal in mind as to what your end game would be? At the conclusion of this, did you know where you wanted to go, or was it just kind of, let's just get this done now and then figure it out later?
I've always been very goal-oriented, and so I think, I felt like, this is how I try to mentor the students, like, what is your goal? And you want to do that, those steps towards that goal in your PhD. So if you want to be a conservation biologist, you don't want to, you know, do a PhD that has no conservation aspects to it, because you're not going to be able to sell yourself at that point. So so I think, you know, I early on wanted to be a faculty member because I found that is, you know, it is what most of these programs are training us to be, as an academic scientist, right? Or an academic historian, or an academic German culture.
Right.
Even though I did want, you know, and I still want my work to be applicable to conservation, I knew that I didn't, you know, necessarily want to work for a conservation organization directly as a career. Although, you know, once you get out and you're in a postdoc and it's really impossible to find a job, you consider everything, including plumbing.
you speak from some experience there.
Oh, yeah. I think that's one of the hardest stages of, you know, of post-PhD is, you know, getting the next job, right? You know, or getting the postdoc in the first place is, you know, where a lot of people drop out. You know, there's a huge attrition after getting a PhD out of academia.
Do you think that's a result of burnout, or is it a result of just not the postdoc positions being available and people just throwing up their hands and going, what I do all this?
It's really complicated. I think part of it is that people realize that, you know, it is, you know, they get through a PhD and they realize it wasn't really what they wanted to do, right? Or a lot of people realize that, you know, the life of an academic is, you know, is not as glamorous as it seems. Like, it's pretty stressful. And so I think that's part of it. Part of it is that, yes, there's not that many postdocs, and they're incredibly competitive. So after every level of postdoc to, you know, to faculty position, it's very, very competitive, which means that you have to be producing at a high level. So in sciences, it means you have to be publishing papers and getting funding, even, you know, before you get an academic job. So, you know, the people in the postdoc I had, that was a think tank, is called the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis.
That's a mouthful.
Yes. but it was, because it was think tank, they had money to bring in about 12 postdocs. And then they had senior scientists that came in and did working groups and sabbaticals and that kind of thing. So it was an amazing situation, a learning situation. But most of those postdocs already had, you know, 3, 4, 5, some might even have had 12 publications under their belt already, you know, the first year out of a PhD.
Walk me through your PhD. When we first got started, I was ribbing you. The only reason you did your PhD is you wanted to spend time in Costa Rica. What did you do?
So, yeah, so I set up the study to better understand how mammals were distributed on mountains in the tropics, essentially. So I looked for mountains that were accessible and that were relatively well protected, you know, so they weren't completely, habitats weren't completely destroyed. And so essentially I went out and put out lots and lots and lots of traps and trapped mammals and tracked their population sizes and where they were on the mountain, so their lowest and highest elevations, and tried to see where on the mountains you see the most species. So where would you predict that, you know, here in the Rockies, where would you see the most species if you were to hike from the bottom to the top of the mountain?
At the lower elevation.
Right. So that, when I started, that was the overall assumption and had been held probably since the early 50s and 60s. But turns out that I found that the highest diversity was at mid-elevations. And so I tried to publish this, and people were like, you're crazy. You know, we all know that diversity is highest at the bottom of the mountain for everything, you know, for trees and for insects and for mammals, birds. And so that brought me to my next chapter, which was I looked at all the data sets that have ever been collected on mountains for mammals. And it turns out that if you look at those that have been best sampled, that 95% of them actually showed mid-elevational peaks in diversity all around the world.
When you're talking about diversity, are you talking about diversity in the sheer number of animals that are located in different species?
Yeah, so okay. Individual, just a count of the species.
Okay.
So how many, you know, each 100 meters as you move up in elevation, you know, are, you know, how many, count how many are in each spot. And it turns out, you know, this is what I ended up spending most of my career, or a lot of my career looking at. It turns out that mid-elevation is the most common pattern for all organisms.
So how is that different in Honduras or in Costa Rica at a mountain that starts at sea level and goes up to, what's the highest mountain in Costa Rica?
It's about 4,100 meters.
Okay. So it's not that 4,100 meters. I can't do the math right now.
Is that 3,100? I don't remember.
How does that compare to like Colorado where we have...
We start high, first of all.
And then where's that mid-range in Colorado is compared to Costa Rica?
It's not absolute elevation. It's the mid-mountain.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And it turns out that if you look at all of the points, so say, you know, there's a point on the mountain that has the highest diversity. So we just say it's one elevation, right? It's a curve, obviously.
Right.
But say that the highest where we've detected is actually an elevation. Turns out if you plot those from all over the world, that they are predictable about where that location on the mountain is. And it looks like it's related to something called the mountain mass effect. So the mass of a mountain, how big it is, influences the climate that's around
right.
it. And so where you have cloud formation and where you get the most water on a mountain is actually at this mid-elevation, but it moves higher on bigger mountains.
Okay.
So you can plot this for small mammals. You can plot that the diversity is sort of tracking this height of the wet area. Just below the wettest area, and those 200 meters is where the highest diversity.
So size does matter.
It does. Sorry. For mammals and mountains.
For mammals and mountains. I apologize. One of the things you talked about in your dissertation was you had a correlation there regarding latitude as well, where latitude being higher, you know, more north or more south as compared. Mm-hmm. What's, did you find that that made a difference as well?
It does. It's in some cases it's misleading, and in some cases it's not. So partly it's misleading in this, what I was talking about, this height of the mountain issue, is that you, if you're on an arid mountain, so say here in the desert southwest, we all know these arid mountains, right? Like you're from Durango. So, you know, it's very deserty at the base, and where you get water, you know, you even get, you know, really nice,
right,
lush habitats are really quite high elevations. So almost all organisms in that type of mountain show a mid-elevational peak because the warmest, wettest conditions are at mid, or, you know, the, not like extremely hot, but like warm and then wet, and are at mid-elevations. And those aren't the tallest mountains, but they have this weird difference of having arid mountain at the bottom and wetter at the top. And so the peaks in diversity in those mountains tend to be a little higher. So it sort of throws off this latitudinal trend. But the other important thing that we found about latitude that I've learned since I've been out of my PhD is that is something that we think about as humans a lot, is that here in the northern latitudes, right, there's really cold temperatures and really warm temperatures at all elevations over the course of the year.
Right.
And so, you know, you move up in elevation, you know, you can find during the different times of year that the mid elevations have the same conditions at a different time of year that the low elevations do. But that's not true in the tropics. So in the tropics, because there's not very little seasonality on the mountains there, you move up, there's almost completely unique conditions at each higher elevation. So they almost show no overlap at any time of the year between the temperatures at the lower and the mid elevations or the high elevations. And so people thought that this might influence the evolution of species that live on those mountains, because here, say in the tropics, I mean in the temperate zone, that things experience much wider variation at the same spot. So they could have wider geographic ranges and their populations could be able to live in many, many different conditions on a mountain. So the prediction was that they would have big ranges. And in the tropics, they would maybe have these very tiny ranges because they only experience a very narrow distribution of temperatures, for instance, at each elevation, and it would be harder to move out of that because then they would be experiencing something completely new. And so we actually did find that on the mountains, on the data that we have compiled for mountains around the world, that in fact it is true that smaller ranges, are species have tinier ranges in the tropics on mountains, and here in the temperate world, whether you're in Europe or Australia or the U.S., that you have bigger ranges in the mountains.
What have you been able to build upon your PhD work? And then what else have you, what have others built upon what you did as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think nowadays, I mean, there were a couple other people at the time I was doing my PhD that found this mid-elevational diversity peak too. And now that's actually the accepted pattern. Whereas, you know, I asked you, you know, it's
going to be down at the bottom. Yeah. Everybody thought that.
Right. And it does occur in some cases, and particularly wet tropical mountains. For birds and bats, you can see that. But for a lot of other organisms, including ferns and moths, and, you know, many, many people have tested this now. And so we have data sets from all over the world for different taxa. And so I think people have been investigating, that's been a big investigation, you know, in the last 15 years is, you know, what causes that mid-elevational peak? You know, where, you know, you would expect there's more land at the bottom of a mountain, right? So you might expect there to be more species that could live down there. But it, you know, that's often not the case. So what is it about mid-elevations? Is it that, you know, that over time, like think about the Pleistocene, you know, that habitats moved up and down on the mountain and shrunk both at the bottom and the top, you know, sometimes got bigger, sometimes got smaller, but the mid-elevations stayed the same. So maybe it's just that there was less extinction in the middle of mountains. So there's just been this proliferation of hypotheses to test about what drives this trend in diversity on mountains. And then I think the other big area people have gone into with this research is that there's an issue of conservation, because a lot of times, you know, you can even see this here in Colorado, we like to protect our mountains, the tops of our mountains, and we like to protect like lowland, you know, really lush maybe waterways and that particular kind of thing. But we don't have a lot of parks at mid elevation. And so, you know, there's this conservation lack that we're not necessarily protecting the areas that are most diverse.
I'm going to bring up climate change here, because that mm-hmm. that you know, it's the whatever it's the word of the day, it seems, or a one of them. Article in the New York Times this week about they've been forwarded a report by some climate scientists in the U.S. government that are afraid that the current administration is going to put their foot down and not allow it. But what I want to ask is, how has that work that you did 20 years ago, mm-hmm. taking a look at the diversity of populations and that benchmark that you found, have you now gone back, or has somebody else gone back to that same area to take a look at how that diversity has changed, mm-hmm. and applying that to issues related to climate or even exploration or extraction?
Yeah. So I've been thinking about going back. So it's been 16 years. Okay. But that's actually what I do here in Colorado. So we've built a database of all known specimens that have ever been caught here for mammals in the state of Colorado since the 1800s.
What's your favorite, by the way?
In Colorado?
Yes. Oh. Quick, your favorite furry mammal.
Probably the pygmy shrew.
Okay, mine's the pine marten. But that's love me a pine marten.
Yeah, they are amazing. So that's what we do here. In fact, that we have been building historical distributions pre-1970s for every species in the state of Colorado, and for the Front Range in particular in the San Juan Mountains. And then we've been trapping on four elevational gradients to see how those ranges have shifted over time, both due to, you know, changes in land use, but also due to warming and changes in patterns of precipitation. And it's quite striking that there's been huge changes. So the bottom line that we're finding is, in fact, that things that live at mid to high elevations are moving higher, which is the expectation. And that unlike the expectation, we're finding a lot of things that live at low elevations are contracting their ranges downward. So like the plains species, we're not finding them as high into the kind of low foothills that they did in the past. And in the San Juans, those really desert-oriented species that are kind of the northern tip of their range that are very desert, you know, New Mexico, Arizona, Mexico, their tip of their range is there in the southwest of Colorado. They are sort of contracting down. And
you're really focused on that in terms of small furry mammals. You said shrews, mice.
Chipmunks, squirrels,
weasels.
We're not doing weasels so much. So essentially rodents and shrews are our focus group. Okay. The numbers of carnivores that we can catch are just so small, right, that we just don't have that ability to detect change as well for them as we do with, you know, a mouse that we can catch hundreds of. And mark them and release them and estimate their population sizes over time. So that's the other thing we're looking at is, you know, is this population at this site staying the same over time? Is it fluctuating greatly? Is it declining?
Are you finding then that the larger mammals that prey on those smaller ones, then as a result of those small mammals moving down, those mountain cats, the smaller carnivores that, that feed on the mice, mm-hmm. are they then tracking down south and into lower elevations?
Possibly. I mean, we aren't actually gathering that data, but what I would say is probably maybe they are, you know, making decisions to hunt down there more.
And then coming back north?
Yeah, because one of the things about elevational ranges is if you're a big animal, your elevation is usually the whole right. mountain, right? Yeah. So, like, think about bighorn sheep or elk. You know, they can go to the top to the bottom over seasons.
Well, let me tell you, in the middle of September, it's just impossible to find them sometimes.
That's true. So, yeah. So, but it is a question both for understanding biodiversity and for understanding how things are responding to climate change is how their each individual animal's food resources are changing with climate change, because it's going to influence them. So that's another thing that we actually look at in our data. We look at biomass of arthropods at sites. We also look at biomass of vegetation at sites.
As an evolutionary biologist, are you finding that there are changes that are going on already in those animals from mm-hmm. an evolutionary standpoint? So, you know, in a human, we have, and I'm just extrapolating, please tell me I'm going to be wrong, but, you know, if we think of a generation, that's generally 20 human years, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a mouse's generation is 12 months?
Less, yeah. I mean, yeah. So the average mouse lives less than a year.
So how... is there any way to tell if there are there changes, genetic changes in those mice going across 20? So let's go back to 1970. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing genetic changes as a result of the mice being forced down in their population?
So we haven't done that specifically, but other people are working on that in different populations, and not just with mice, but with grasshoppers and different things. And yes, there are evolutionary repercussions. And that's because the bottom line with evolution is just who survives things and what genes they carry. So say, you know, we wipe out everything that was, you know, at the foothills end, and everything else lives at the lowest end in these really lush, maybe grassland areas near agriculture. Like, they're just a subset of individuals that are living in that particular setting. They probably have different genetics, right? So just by the fact that you have killed off a population that had a particular, you know, affinity for some different type of habitat means that has an evolutionary repercussion, because that's all evolution is, right? It's just the numbers of genes associated with different things, right? So if you have a die-off that's specific to a particular habitat or trait or behavior, you're going to have an evolutionary repercussion. One of the other things that people look at a lot is genetic diversity. So the idea is that if you have a diverse number of genes for various aspects, then you maybe are going to be more resilient to change, whether that any kind of anthropogenic change, not just habitat loss or climate change. And so people have asked that question of the things that are moving more or are declining in populations in response to warming, do they have less genetic diversity? And in some cases, that has been found to be the case, and in other cases, not. So,
I want to get back to the art part of your education. At this point in postgraduate and into where you're at now.
Like an old person?
Not as old as me.
By 2 years, maybe.
No, probably a little bit more. But those skills, the underlying base of being an artist, how has that shaped what you're able to accomplish as a research scientist?
My figures are beautiful. No, but I think, I mean, they are really different. Like, I do miss doing art just for pure art's sake. You know, it's something that I want to do more than I have necessarily time. But I think for I think it, for me, it dovetails more with outreach and conservation. So I teach a class called Creative Conservation Messaging. It's a graduate level class and it's tiny. There's like 10 or 12 students. And we just explore it, each semester that I've done it, we explore different ways of trying to have a conservation message to people that maybe aren't interested in conservation in the first place. And the first year we did it was all focused on the arts, all different kinds of arts, using and looking at people and then students doing projects that use different arts. So music, radio, dance. We had a student that was a dance graduate student. She did an entire dance. We had, you know, all various different things that people did. And we brought in, you know, visual artists. We brought in dancers. We went to E-Town and talked with them. So I think, you know, that's where I've tried to bring in more of my, you know, really more of that creative side of trying to use different abilities to reach a conservation audience. As far as being creative as a scientist, I don't know if I've been so successful.
Do you think you get stuck in a rut, for lack of a better term, and you stay so focused on what it is that you're doing that that other side of your brain goes, well, why do we even try that, you know?
Yeah, and I think you dismiss a lot of really creative ideas when you're using, you know, just a scientific method. Because, you maybe dismiss them before they're given their adequate due, you know? But you do, you know, you've just heard me talk about my research a lot, and not everybody does it this way, but don't worry, that's, you know, this.
I have stained your table with my lemonade, sorry about that.
Oh, it was $5 from Goodwill, so. You know, you do get in a particular vein of research, and you already have kind of 5 more questions you're interested in going to, you know? So, it's, you know, it's hard to sometimes come up with, you know, it's not hard to come up with creative ideas, but, you know, to follow them through or for even to have time to follow all of them through. So, but I think, there's pluses and minuses in science that what people call creativity in science isn't always the same creativity you would have as an artist. In some ways it is. You know, some ways it's just letting your mind wander into areas that you hadn't, or you know, really bringing disparate ideas together. But in science, you know, sometimes you're very stifled by just the systematic nature of what you do, you know, and the stats and the way you can design studies. And, you know, you get kind of wrapped up in a way of doing things that can be kind of stifling this to creativity. But I think as you get older, you have more flexibility. So you don't have to stay in this, you know, particular area. And for instance, I've gotten really interested in, weirdly enough, carrion beetles. And this is the organisms that decompose dead stuff,
right,
but mostly mammals. And
bears love them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're a tasty treat if you're, you know, you're an animal too. So, you know, I might end up, you know, in 5 years you could interview me and I'll just be doing behavior.
That's not a vertebrate. That's
no, it's an insect. Yeah, so I have students, like I have a student who finished his PhD looking at these same questions in ants on these same gradients we have here in Colorado. And he also had historical data on the ants and has been looking at how they're changing. So, but yeah, I think it's still, that's probably still, you know, a goal of mine is to better integrate kind of that creative side and the science side.
What teaching do you do?
So because I'm the curator of the Natural History Museum or the vertebrates, I have a half teaching load, but I teach, so I teach mammalogy, which is the study of mammals. It's an undergrad grad course. It's both. And then I also teach this graduate student course, the creative conservation messaging, and I switch off years. So one year I do mammalogy, one year I do that creative conservation messaging.
Do you get a chance to see really many freshmen or sophomores, or you're more the upper grad kids?
Yeah, my class is a junior senior, but mostly seniors. But we in the museum, we employ a lot of students and volunteers. And surprisingly, you know, the kids that come in, and we have kids that come in tours, you know, so the freshmen, you can sign up for tours. And last year we got a few, you know, freshmen, and I have a freshman that started working in my lab. So, and it's great to get them early because, you know, then they have 4 years to develop some really neat ideas and can do projects as undergrads. So I think that's usually the interaction I have with, you know, the freshmen and sophomores is, you know, if they come and are interested in my research and want to work in the lab, or are interested in our collection and skinning bears or whatever.
That's for another story that still whacked me out the first time I saw a skinned bear out in the wild, and having had a physiology class here in college that I took pass-fail, but still understanding basic human muscle tone and seeing the bear splayed out on the... It was pretty whack. It's a bear, but it looks an awful lot like a human as well.
Yeah. All mammals look a lot alike under
yes,
there.
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. What do you tell the new... So if I'm a PhD potential student walking in and you've said yes, come in and play with me, what are you telling me on the first day that... What are your expectations of a PhD student coming in based on what you've learned and what you see ahead?
Yeah, I mean, so I think, you know, that I do feel like the PhD is where they are supposed to grow as a scientist, right? So it's no longer, you know, spoon-feeding information or just like, here, learn all this stuff. It's more... develop as a scientist and ask questions and be curious and then design studies to ask those questions that you're interested in. So, you know, usually what I tell people is to read a lot that first year and talk to me about ideas. And then the other thing I tell them is that this is your time to learn skills. You know, so it's much harder once you're out of grad school to learn skills, you know, new skills. So like biostatistics or learning how to do molecular analyses of genetics, or GIS, or various different, you know, whether, you know, isotopes are a big thing nowadays. So, you know, those skills, this is a perfect place to learn skills because there's all these experts here and they're teaching classes. That's what I try to tell them or try to encourage in them is to develop their own science, but also to gather these skills that, you know, they're in a place to do it easily. And then I also emphasize usually that I think building, all of us scientists do this, is building on past knowledge. So really be, you know, if you decide, say, carrion beetle behavior is going to be your thing, you know, look at everything that's been done on that already and then build from that. Don't start, you know, recreate all those things that people did in the past, you know, so because it saves you time, right? I mean, it's already been done, so... but yeah, each person is really different. I think, you know, getting back to what we've originally talked about is mentoring has to be more about what the students need particularly. Some students need more writing skills, or in others, you know, they're just perfect in writing and they need a little bit more, you know, encouragement on exploring things beyond, you know, the initial maybe reaction. So it's just really, you know, it's more about sort of learning that student and being able to ascertain what is best for them.
What's going to happen to Kevin?
Well, Kevin already finished. He's still finishing up. So he's what they call ABD, right?
All but dissertation.
Yes. And so, but he already started a job. So he works for the Environmental Defense Fund. And they give him a certain amount of time to finish up his dissertation. But he's doing, in his dissertation, is applied conservation. So in particular, he works on kind of extinction risk and triage. You know, who should you save and how should you save it? How should you use funds? You know, we know funds are limited. And
So it sounds like that, it seems to, just looking at that from here, that's probably not necessarily a bench top scientist type of look or study. He's mm-hmm. He may be a little bit more taking a look at it from a communication or a humanities type of.
Well, it's more modeling. So it's building a lot of models based on data that we have on, you know.
Gotcha.
So, and he's doing it kind of at the global scale. So he builds models about where species ranges are and it is a little bit of social science where he looks at how much money different countries have. Gotcha. And what kind of laws they have. But it's also at this kind of global scale of looking at biodiversity and making different kind of decisions about how you're going to protect. Are you going to protect the rarest things?
So it's using the science background that he's been able to develop here, and maybe taking a look at it from a political policy standpoint as well. Mm-hmm. So having to take advantage of those skills.
It's more interdisciplinary than you maybe a pure like ecology and evolution.
Last question for you. I got a sophomore in high school. He's going to be a science kid. What's the biggest need in, let's talk about biology, that life sciences. What do you see for as you sit here? What's that need in 5 or 10 years?
For people or for what they study?
For what they study. Well, I mean, it's a huge... I mean, we're still probably going to be talking about climate science and conservation.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? We're at this crux of, you know, are we at a turning point that, you know, we're never going to be able to go back from, you know, and it's all downhill from here? Or are we still at a place that change is not inevitable? So I think, you know, clearly there's going to be, you know, people that understand both climates and organisms, you know, to apply to conservation. I think that obviously that's going to be, you know, a big need. But there's still need for just intrinsic basic biology, because those studies find surprising new avenues, right, that are applicable beyond pure science, right? So I think... You know, I think because biology is the study of the natural world, and, you know, I think we're always, that kind of work is always going to be in demand as long as there is a natural world.
Thank you very much for your time. I know that I got to thank Andy again up at Albums on the Hill. Oh, what was the last thing you bought from Andy?
Oh, Ryan Adams' new album.
Don't be embarrassed. It's a great album. It really is. Thank you very much, Christy. Appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Want to say thank you again to Dr. Christy McCain up at the University of Colorado Natural History Museum. Really had a great time talking with her. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I think it really gives a little different perspective of the PhD journey. She certainly had some interesting adventures there in Nicaragua during her Peace Corps time. So thanks again, Christy. And Andy, keep setting them up. Really appreciate your help. And I'll see you on Friday. I know you got a stack of music for me as well. So we'll talk to you again here in a couple of weeks. Thanks for shoveling with me today. And again, tell your friends about it. And if you like what you hear, please let me know and give me your comments. Check out my blog at themountaingeek.net. Give me a comment on the Twitter at PhD Podcast or my personal Twitter feed at themountaingeek. I think I also need to do a better job on the Facebook page. But have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon.